going up.
Prices keep going up these days. It feels like being on an elevator that only goes up.
Going up.
But not at Metro. We're pushing the down button.
Going down.
We've lowered prices and give you a 5-year price guarantee on talk, text, and data. Get one line of 5G data for $40, period. That's 20% lower. Only at Metro.
5-year guarantee on eligible plans. Exclusions apply. See website for details. Not available at Metro with T-Mobile in the past 6 months. Tax applies.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance, too, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Every morning brings a fresh new energy.
This is Today with
Sophie. And no matter what the day holds, we come to the Today Show for all of it.
When things are tough, we talk about it. When there's something to figure out, we dig into it. And when there's joy, we celebrate it.
Because today is where it's all happening. We get the best start to every morning because we start it together.
Watch the Today Show with Savannah Guthrie and Craig Melvin weekdays at 7 a.m. on NBC.
It's Saturday night with Esme Murphy.
It's 7:08 in the Twin Cities. Esme Murphy with you back on a Saturday night. It's so great to be back on CCO Radio along with our producer, Devin. It's kind of a gloomy night, kind of a little chillier than you might be used to, but stay warm right here by listening to us. Well, this half hour, I wanted to talk about the situation in Hong Kong because I think a lot of people are kind of going, what is going on over there? We're joined now by Ann Waltner. She is a professor of history at the University of Minnesota. Thank you so much, Ann, for coming on.
It's a pleasure.
All right. Well, let me ask you this. I mean, I know very little about Chinese history. The one thing that I do know about, you know, Hong Kong and Chinese history is that sort of the seminal event happened, I believe, in 1997 when Hong Kong was no longer a British colony. It was sort of handed over to China. I don't know if I'm using the correct terminology, but it was after more than a century of colonial rule, it became a sort of a province of China. And that obviously was a huge change, but that was more than 20 years ago. And there hasn't been this kind of, you know, dramatic protests since then, has there?
Yes, that's right. There have actually been some protests since then, but nothing like this. When the handover, and you are correct, actually, handover is the term that's used, was made in 1997, there was a deal made that for 50 years, Hong Kong would be governed by special provisions. The term that was used is one country, two systems. Hong Kong still has its own currency. They still drive on the British side of the road.
Oh, really?
Really. An American citizen does not need a visa to visit Hong Kong.
Wow.
A Chinese citizen does need special permissions. It's not exactly a visa to visit Hong Kong. Things like freedom of speech are much more carefully reserved in Hong Kong than they are in China. So there is a transitional period between 1997 and 2047 to gradually incorporate Hong Kong into China.
Okay. And so, I guess I didn't realize it, and that's why I'm so glad we had you on. I didn't realize that there was this big transitional period. So we're in a transitional period. Yet it seems to be the transition, especially this particular year, seems to be especially rocky. I mean, what happened?
Well, the precipitating event was a law which would have allowed people who committed crimes in Hong Kong to be extradited to China. And I think people in Hong Kong felt, probably quite rightly, that the legal guarantees and legal protections in China were not as strong as they were in Hong Kong. And I think they were also worried that the law might be used to extradite political prisoners. And so at the beginning of the summer, there were a series of protests, you know, every weekend, with increasing intensity about the law. And the law has subsequently been withdrawn. But it seems to me that sometime maybe in the middle of the summer, maybe even a little earlier than that, what started to happen was kind of fundamental unease about what's going to happen in 2047. In 2047, Hong Kong will be just another Chinese city. And I think it's not just another Chinese city now. Things are quite different. And so I think that in a sense, what is happening is people are articulating a kind of long-term unease about the future of Hong Kong.
All right. But can it ever really be, quote, just another Chinese city with that kind of a history?
Well, that's actually a great question. I mean, I think that the Chinese can subject it to the same legal procedures and things that other cities, other places are subject to. I mean, one of the things that has been true of Hong Kong, since the foundation of the People's Republic of China in 1949, Hong Kong has been essential to China because it was kind of China's window to the world. That I think Hong Kong has been extremely important to China's economic growth, financial growth. And one of the things that may be happening now is China may have decided that Hong Kong is no longer as essential as it once was. There are places like Shenzhen, which is really just a subway ride away from Hong Kong. I think it probably takes 30 minutes on the subway to get there. You have to get out of the train and cross the border and get back in. And what has always been so important about Hong Kong for China is that it was a place where foreign capital was comfortable, and the rules, enough of the rules have changed in places like, and Shenzhen is in a special economic zone, so there may be other places that can fulfill some of the economic and financial functions that Hong Kong has been filling. One of the things that I think people have probably noticed when protesters in Hong Kong are being interviewed, sort of man-on-the-street interviews by Western media, people speak quite good English. I mean, that's really a legacy of British colonialism. I think also the belief in civil liberties, the belief in the rights of free speech and things like that I think are very strongly held in Hong Kong. I think that also comes from 150 years of British colonialism. So, I mean, you're suggesting that a political act can't overturn all of that all of a sudden, I think is quite right.
What do you think is going to happen? Because it seems like this crisis has been obviously going on for some time now, and it's pretty tense.
It is pretty tense. I have no idea what's going to happen. I suspect that both the Hong Kong government and the Chinese government are just hoping that it will dissipate on its own. I think that there is a little bit less solidarity among the protesters now than there was in the very beginning. I mean, in the very beginning, you had marches that were, you know, like mothers in front of the protesters. And one of my favorites was accountants marching in favor of the protesters, you know, wearing their blue accountant suits. And I think that there's been a little bit of fracturing. I think that the increasing violence has made some people quite wary. So it could simply be that it will dissipate. I think that a violent crackdown would be catastrophic.
Right. Well, and to a certain extent, though, I mean, there have been pretty dramatic violent crackdowns. I mean, I think that there was video just last week of somebody, one protester, being shot at point-blank range.
Yeah.
It was just about as graphic as you can get, and there it was on the morning news.
Yeah. No, I mean, there definitely has been violence. And, in fact, one of the things that I think has happened a bit in the last couple of weeks is in some ways the target of the protesters has changed a bit from being from being anxiety about the PRC to being hostility toward the Hong Kong police. And so I think that there is violence, but I think, I mean, for example, the kind of crackdown that happened in 1989, in China with Tiananmen, where troops are simply sent in and the demonstrators are killed. I think that would be catastrophic, and I don't expect
be catastrophic for China.
I think it would be catastrophic for China, and it would certainly be catastrophic for Hong Kong. I mean, I think that even though I was just now saying that I think that there are ways in which there are other cities which have to some degree taken up the economic and political importance of Hong Kong, there's still nowhere quite like Hong Kong in terms of the ways in which it functions as a financial center. And I think, you know, I think financial centers are very fragile. All you have to do is make financial entities feel uncomfortable, and they can leave, and it wouldn't take very long to kind of undo the importance of Hong Kong. And I think it's fragile now. I mean, one of the things that people were expecting prior to 1997 is that there would be great capital flight out of Hong Kong, and that didn't really happen. I think, you know, a lot of rich people got permanent residency in Canada and bought houses in Vancouver and things like that, but its financial prominence wasn't destroyed. And I think that there's kind of this fragile dance. The whole time that Hong Kong was a British colony from 1842 to 1997, China controlled Hong Kong's water supply, and if they had wanted to bring the British to their knees, all they would have had to do is cut off the water supply. But Hong Kong, as a British colony, was useful and important. So it's kind of a long, convoluted history, and that was a very long and convoluted way of my giving you an I don't know answer to your question.
Well, let me ask you this. How big a deal do you think this whole controversy involving the NBA is? The general manager of one of the teams tweets out support for the Hong Kong protesters, and the next thing you've got the NBA apologizing, and then they're apologizing for their apology. And there's a lot of discussion about it. I mean, it's sort of people who don't ordinarily discuss this or look at foreign politics or problems in other countries are suddenly looking at this now.
Well, I think it is very interesting. I mean, it shows the power of the Chinese government. And it shows the power of Chinese commercial entities like Huawei and Tencent and groups like that. And, you know, if the NBA says things that the Chinese government doesn't like, then the Chinese government can refuse to show the NBA. And it just shows how convoluted these things are. And it also, I guess, goes to show just what a complicated concept free speech is. I mean, in theory, you know, people in the NBA can say whatever they want, but then all of a sudden, you know, the shows in Peking are shut down, and sort of, oops, maybe we'd better backtrack. I mean, I think it's very interesting, and I think it does make you kind of think about, you know, who has the right to say what, where, and how can that be manipulated by political and commercial interests?
Right, right. Obviously, you know, a lot of people discussing that. Well, listen, Professor Ann Walter from the University of Minnesota, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate this little history lesson in some of the situations that are going on in Hong Kong, which obviously we're seeing it on the news really almost
every
daily.
Day.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. Thank you so much. We really appreciate your time this evening.
You're welcome.
All right. And we're going to talk more about China and the NBA coming up with Chris Hine, who's a Timberwolves reporter for the Star Tribune. How did the NBA get to be so big? How big is it? What are the plans for expansion? And what is the impact, perhaps, if there's a shutdown of the NBA in China? We're all going to talk and chat about that with Chris Hine coming up in our next half hour. First, though, we should probably take a break and pay some bills. You're listening to News Talk 830.
Basketball is my favorite sport. I like the way the dribble up and down the court.
There you go. 735 in the Twin Cities, basketball. A lot of people didn't realize how big a deal basketball was in China until the past week when there was that tweet by the general manager of the Houston Rockets supporting those protesters in Hong Kong. And suddenly it was a big deal. And you had all kinds of comments by folks in China, as well as the NBA. The NBA apologizing for the tweet. Then they apologized for the apology. A lot going on. And then, you know, a blackout in China of NBA games. Definitely a situation that I think a lot of people didn't realize quite how big the NBA was in China, how big business it is, and the NBA's hopes for expansion apparently lie largely right now in the Chinese market. But somebody who knows a lot more about this than I do is Chris Hine. He is the Timberwolves beat reporter for the Star Tribune. Hey there, Chris. How are you?
I'm doing good. How are you?
Well, fine. Thanks. Great to have you on. I really appreciate it. I guess I would be remiss if I didn't ask you, just first of all, your preseason thoughts about the Timberwolves.
Yeah, it's going to be a different year for the Timberwolves. New regime in charge. Actually, their president came from the Houston Rockets, Gerson Rosas, and so they're trying to install kind of more modern, up-tempo, 3-point oriented shooting kind of offense, and you know, trying to find the right personnel, I think, to carry them forward here the next few years with Carl Anthony Towns at the helm of the team. So there's a lot of experimentation and a lot of kind of feeling each other out early in the preseason here, and we'll see what happens in a crowded Western Conference this season. It's going to be tough sledding for them to make the playoffs, I think.
Can those kind of changes, the front office changes, make really a difference?
It can, because, you know, it dictates kind of the style of play, what kind of players you're targeting to bring in here. It really does kind of alter the course of the franchise. And one thing that the Wolves have been big on this summer is establishing a new kind of team culture that wasn't always present in previous years, especially under Tom Thibodeau. Last year, there was a lot of kind of chaos and disruption when Jimmy Butler was requesting a trade and wanted out of town. And
he was fun to watch when he was on, but my goodness, what a disaster.
It made for a really interesting fan experience, I think, because, you know, 2 seasons ago, you know, they had their best season in 15 years and they made the playoffs. But on the other hand, it didn't look like the team particularly enjoyed playing with each other. And I think that spilled over to the fans and the experience of watching the team. And, you know, obviously that those relationships did not hold long term.
Right. And I am a very casual fan, and I did not go last season, but I went the season before to a couple of games, and boy, were they fun to watch. I mean, these players are really fun to watch, and they're so young and so talented, and you kind of hope that for the best for the team. I mean, I remember sort of, you know, the days of, you know, when the team was doing well and made the playoffs, and you're kind of like wishing that could happen again.
Yeah, and you know, I think this new kind of president and the front office, they are thinking more long term. I think the previous front office and Tom Thibodeau was thinking very short term, like let's trade away some of our young players to try and get in the playoffs now. And when you haven't made the playoffs in over a decade, it's a smart thing to do. It's just the execution of it and the moves that they made ended up kind of blowing back up in their face. This regime, I think, is trying to plan out for the long haul so that the Wolves will be good in a few years, and their goal is to be perennial contenders eventually.
We're chatting with Chris Hines, the Timberwolves reporter for the Star Tribune. I do want to ask him about, NBA in China, but I do want to ask you, like, in terms of a beat reporter, I mean, there's some people probably out there listening saying, God, that must be a really cool job, being a beat reporter for a professional sports team. But is it like, do you have your preseason ritual or routine that you have to go through? Because, I mean, you're on the road with them.
Yeah, you know what's funny is that I was in Phoenix the other night, and I was covering the first preseason game, and my editors gave me a time for my deadline, and I actually forgot my deadline time, and I had it mixed up in my head, and I realized it with about 5 minutes to go that, oh, I have to file in 5 minutes, not 15 minutes. So, you know, it's preseason for the writers as well.
Right. Those deadlines are just a little bit important in your line of work.
Yeah, they are. That 10 minutes can mean everything.
Yes, like keeping your job.
That's right. I did not tell them that. So if anybody's listening in our office, now they know that I almost missed my first deadline of the year.
Right. Well, and Phoenix is a little tricky because you never know. Sometimes they're on Pacific time and sometimes they're not.
Right. Exactly.
So I'll give you a pass on that one. But but seriously, I mean, do you have to kind of get prepped or just, I mean, because it's a long season.
Yeah. It's a long season. So in my head and kind of working with the Wolves, I have a number of stories that I want to eventually write. Not just like the daily kind of stories that you see every day in the paper, but kind of longer form feature kind of stories. You know, that might appear in like the Sunday paper, for instance. And so you do have a list of those that you want to try to accomplish as the season goes along. But honestly, like, you start writing stuff, you know, once they start playing games and you kind of see how the team goes. And a lot of that is just based off of how guys are doing. So
right.
There's only so much preparation you can do.
And it must be really cool to travel and at that. But after a while, I mean, it there's part of it that's got to be pretty grueling.
Yeah, I like to travel. Personally, I like to travel more so than I think other people might. I'm in my early 30s. I'm single. I don't have a family, so I enjoy the travel. But I look at the schedule, and there's a 6-game road trip in March that I'm especially on edge about, because it's going to be later in the season. I'm going to be traveling to 6 different cities in the span of about 11 or 12 days. And so that one I'm looking at thinking that, you know, I might need a little break once that one's over.
All right. Well, listen, Chris, you know, I think a lot of people didn't, you know, especially the casual fans or casual sports fans, or maybe they're not somebody who follows the NBA closely. I didn't realize how big a deal the NBA is in China. I mean, how big is it?
It's huge. And the NBA has really done a good job, you know, the last few weeks, notwithstanding here, of cultivating that relationship in China. It goes back really to the turn of the 20th century when Christian missionaries brought the game over to China. And it was one of the few things that once Mao took power, he allowed basketball and access to basketball to still happen.
Really?
So,
okay.
Yeah. So,
the cultural revolution didn't, you know, throw out basketball. That was still in.
Right. It did not, because I believe I read that his generals really liked the game. So that's one of the reasons why it ended up staying. So it did stay for decades, and it has deep roots in China. And
wow.
In the 80s, the NBA kind of looked and said, there might be an opportunity here. And the 80s was kind of the rebirth of the NBA. This was the era of, you know, Larry Bird, Magic Johnson, Michael Jordan. And things were opening up in U.S. relations with China. So the NBA actually struck a deal, I think it was in 1990, with Chinese state-run TV to start airing highlights and games in China.
Wow.
And this is right around the time where the NBA is surging in popularity in America. Some of the best players of all time are now playing. And, you know, it coincides with really the rise of Michael Jordan. And then in 1992, you have the Dream Team, which is all these Hall of Fame players on one team going to the Olympics. And that did wonders for the game, not just in, you know,
really?
In China, but the rest of the world, because the rest of the world got to see these great players on one stage. Previously, you know, the top NBA players were not going to the Olympics. Now they were. And so this
that's right, because it used to be the amateurs, and then you had
right, exactly. So this was, you know, now you're seeing Larry Bird playing with Charles Barkley and Michael Jordan and Magic and Isaiah Thomas and all these guys, and it was quite the spectacle back in the early 90s. And so it kind of kept rising from there throughout the 90s, throughout Jordan. But a big touchstone moment came in 2002 when Chinese center Yao Ming became the number one pick in the NBA draft by the Houston Rockets. And so Yao Ming, and he became an all-star in the NBA. He had a great career,
right.
You know, a little injury prone, but when he was playing, he was one of the best centers in the NBA. And so that, you know, more than I think anything, sent, you know, basketball's popularity just skyrocketing in China. And now it's routine for players, you know, with shoe deals and things like that to make annual off-season trips to China for marketing purposes and to do, you know, appearances for fans and things like that. Almost every major NBA star does that in the off-season now.
Right, and that's something that I didn't realize. Well, this is really interesting just to hear this. And so it sounds as if, you know, people have been playing basketball for years in China, for generations, really, and enjoying it the way we do in schools. And I think there's that familiarity, and then it's a couple of key moments, and then to have, you know, a Chinese person do that well and become a major star, a superstar. You're saying that was one of the pivotal moments here.
Yeah, exactly. Really, really, this didn't happen overnight. It was kind of the NBA's, I think, forward thinking back in the 80s and 90s. You know, so in this age of technology, it's now become easier to broadcast the games and to have access to highlights and social media and whatnot. But the roots of the NBA's growth in China were planted a long time ago. It didn't just happen with the age of technology.
Right.
This has been happening for at least three or four decades now. Okay.
So, and Yao Ming, you know, went on to have, as you said, a super successful career in Houston. I think didn't he play for Houston his entire career?
I believe so. Yes.
Yeah. And then he goes back to China and he becomes the face of Chinese basketball, right?
Yes.
Okay. And explain what he is the head of over in China.
That I'm not 100% sure, but I do know that he does a lot of promotion of the game. He is probably the main face of the NBA in China, and he's really had to try and distance himself from his former team amid this latest controversy. And, you know, it's been kind of interesting to read the reaction to the games that have been happening over there. And it really, a lot of
there have been some NBA games over there.
Yes,
yeah.
But there has been a limit on, you know, the broadcast of these games. There have been a few preseason games scheduled over there. But the broadcast has been blacked out. I think fans have still shown up to these games, but you read reports about how fans have really mixed feelings now, and because the population definitely feels one way about the situation in Hong Kong, but they still love the NBA.
Wow, interesting. What, just from where you sit, you're obviously, your job is to, cover and follow the NBA and follow the Minnesota Timberwolves. But where do you see this kind of going, or what's kind of, is there any consensus among, reporters such as yourself that follow the NBA about what happens next? I mean, how big of a storyline is this going forward? I would think it would be significant for the growth of this sport.
Yeah, no, I don't think anybody has a good feel for how the Chinese government is going to react, what the limitations are going to be. The NBA has $1 billion streaming deal with one of the tech companies in China, and
that's a billion
a billion with a B. It's how is that going to be affected by this, and it has a trickle down effect. I read a report, I believe from Yahoo Sports this past week, where NBA GMs, because of the fallout, are reevaluating the projections for the salary cap over the next 2 years, because if any of this fallout, affects the amount of money coming into the NBA, it is therefore going to affect how much money teams are going to have to spend on players.
This could be felt at the front office, down at Target Center.
Yes, it could. Yes, it could. Absolutely. But it's so soon. And I think everything is so raw emotionally right now that it's hard to really say where this is going to go in the next few weeks and months.
Right. Yeah. And it's, and obviously when the story first broke and then there were the apologies for the tweet, I think a lot of people were kind of going, what? And then there's the apology for the apology, and obviously a lot of repercussions down the line. But the backdrop is that this is a huge institution really now in China. Well, listen, Chris, it's a pleasure to talk to you. Get ready for the season. Do you have to do things like all your holiday shopping now or something like that? You're a single guy, so you don't have a family, so that makes it easier to travel.
I mean, I do have, my family is back home in Pennsylvania where I grew up, so Amazon helps with Christmas shopping. let me just say that.
Yeah. All right. I think we're all in that column these days. Good luck with the season, and we will obviously be watching for your work in the Star Tribune. He is Chris Hine, the Timberwolves beat reporter for the Star Tribune. Thank you so much.
No problem. Anytime. Thank you.
Okay. Take care. All right. That was interesting hearing. He had a really nice perspective about the history of the NBA in China. And I don't think I'd heard anybody kind of go into the deeper roots. I'm sort of like a history geek nerd here. And I had never heard, I'd read about the Yao Ming and how Yao Ming was really big. And, obviously these superstars are very charismatic. But I'd never heard it go back to Chairman Mao, and that when Chairman Mao was in the Cultural Revolution, when so much, they were getting rid of so many different things in China, so many people were arrested and so many Western things were just dismissed or not allowed, that basketball was okay. And that's an interesting point, that it has made those kinds of inroads, because I think you've got to have that kind of inroad as well for it to resonate, that people have, done this in gym class and kind of grown up or watched teams or had friends that have played and they've played. So interesting stuff. We'll have to keep following that. Well, listen, folks, we do have to take a break. You are listening to News Talk 830.
Esme Murphy.
It is 7:54 in the Twin Cities, 37 degrees. Esme Murphy back on a Saturday night along with Devin, our producer. And I was just saying in the break, I haven't been here in so long because of the Twins. And I was saying they've got a fancy new coffee machine. And, I just feel like I haven't been here in ages. And I guess I sort of haven't.
But yeah, when was the last time you were here?
Well, it was in July. July was a long time ago.
Yeah.
And some of the topics we've talked about, the vaping crisis wasn't a thing.
Nope.
the Twins were just still red hot. And, you know, I think we were all still sort of hoping that they'd still be playing right now.
Yeah.
I was even hoping they would still be playing until
late Monday night.
Yeah. But they did do well. We certainly hope that next year, there's always next year. But I felt a little badly with because our other producer, Susan Blanche, she actually kind of was setting up the show, and I didn't call her until Tuesday morning. And I felt, well, should I have called her earlier? But I thought, no, that would be kind of jinxing the twins, say, you know, to plan ahead for them to lose. And I was not planning for them to lose. I thought maybe this was the year they could break that Yankee curse. I was wrong. Anyway, but so we had set up like a full show, and I had talked to David Schultz. Professor David Schultz, who we talked to and have talked to for years on this show in the 8 o'clock hour, I had talked to him about a week and a half ago, and he was going on a major trip for the State Department to Eastern Europe. But I hadn't talked to him about possibly doing a show tonight because the Twins were still playing. And I thought, well, of course, they'll still be playing. The playoffs will still be going on. Well, unfortunately, that happened. And then, you know, by the time Tuesday came around, he was already sort of in Latvia, and I was trying to text him, but I guess the text messages didn't work and email, so I assumed that he would still be there. Then he calls me, or he texts me last night and calls me last night saying he's back. So we had to shift the show around. So Susan Blanche, thank you so much for being flexible on doing that, because we will have Dave Schultz on after this, and there's so much to talk about. First of all, I'd like to hear about his trip to Eastern Europe, because I think it's interesting to hear what people are saying and thinking and talking about the U.S. in this really volatile time, obviously, and how much play the impeachment talk is getting, how much play the president's rallies are getting. I'll also talk about I was there at the Target Center, and I was there. I saw about an hour of the president's speech. The president actually spoke for an hour and 40 minutes. And I was actually, my angle was sort of the president's supporters. And we had somebody doing the protesters, and we had Pat Kessler doing the whole speech. But I did get inside and looked at, you know, for an hour of the speech. One thing that is remarkable is I've seen a lot of presidents speak. Whatever you think of President Trump, he goes off prompter. A lot of this is just ad-libbed. I mean, he's got an unbelievable stamina for public speaking that's just remarkable, and he obviously just loves it. I mean, he really, really loves it. Whatever you want to say about it, he really clearly enjoys what he's doing, and he clearly enjoyed that at times, I would say, off-color talk he gave to the crowd at Target Center. They loved it. So I can't wait to talk to David Schultz about all of these things. Obviously, he's got the legal background as well, so we can ask him about the intricacies of impeachment. And can't wait to hear from him on his trip for the State Department to Eastern Europe. News Talk 830. Keep it here.